everybody. Hi, how are you doing today? It's a beautiful, beautiful, warm, sunny day here in New York City. And I'm very happy to be here today to talk about something really chewy and juicy. We're going to be talking about burgers today. And before I do, I just wanted to direct you to my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. You may or may not be aware that tonight is the start of the Plant-Powered and Thriving Expert Series. There will be three of them, and it's brought to you by the Food Revolution Network. And I'm a part of that team with John and Ocean Robbins. Tonight, they'll be talking with Joel Fuhrman, my favorite medical doctor, and I'm sure there'll be lots of interesting and new information that you may not have heard about yet. And then Chris Wark is another part of the series in a couple of days. And then the last expert on this series is me, and I'll be talking about my favorite subject, food, and how much I love healthy, delicious, vegan, plant food, whole food. It's just a topic that I can't seem to shut up about, and I'll be talking a bit about that with John and Ocean Robbins on June 2nd. So I hope you get an opportunity to tune in. That's the Plant-Powered and Thriving Expert Series, and go to responsibleeatingandliving.com, and you can get more information about that. Excellent. Carol Adams is with us. She's the author of numerous books, including The Sexual Politics of Meat, Neither Man Nor Beast, Feminism and the Defense of Animals, and The Pornography of Meat. She is the co-editor of several path-breaking anthologies, including Ecofeminism, Feminist Intersections with Other Animals and the Earth with Lori Gruen. Her work is the subject of two recent anthologies, Defiant Daughters, 21 Women of Art, Activism, Animals, and The Sexual Politics of Meat and The Art of Animal. 14 Women Artists Explore the Sexual Politics of Meat, in which a new generation of feminists, artists, and activists respond to Adams' groundbreaking work. Today, we're talking about one of her new books, Burger. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Thanks for having me on, Karen.
You're welcome. I made sure to eat before we started talking about burgers.
It's so funny. When I was working on this book, I wanted to eat burgers every day. It was so, I've never had quite that experience writing a book. And of course, I've got books on veggie burgers and making your own veggie burgers. And there's so many choices. So I did not actually have to eat the same veggie burger every day, even when I craved it.
Well, some of the book makes burgers not sound very delicious, but there are other parts that just get my mouth watering, and we'll touch on all of that. What's fascinating to me about reading the book and thinking about the burger is that it is so symbolic of humanity and our culture, so many dimensions.
It's fascinating when you start to look at it, especially in terms of the myth-making of the United States. How the burger had to become central to who we are within the United States as citizens, and then becomes this representation that gets exported all around the world. So there's American burgers that you can, joints that you can go to in London or in Scotland, in Toronto, where something that is claimed to have been created here, it just gets reproduced over and over and over again.
We are living this myth of history, this myth of who we are, who we're supposed to be, what we expect ourselves to be, how people from outside of the United States are supposed to treat us. It's one big, giant myth, and the hamburger sits on top of it.
It's very true. When I decided to write about the burger, I knew that I wanted the trajectory to be something that looked at the hamburger, but did not assume the hamburger was the be-all and end-all of consumption. So I made a couple decisions. One was that I would define the burger as a single protein, single portion protein patty. And once I did that, I could look throughout history for other examples of single portion protein patties. And I found them in 2500 BCE, Southern India, the falafel, croquettes and veggie cutlets all would qualify. One of the things that does is it dismantles the idea that vegans are just trying to reproduce something that was a meat-based food. Because if we were eating these kind of textures and shapes before the hamburger was ostensibly created at the end of the 19th century, then it isn't that we're seeking to reproduce meat, but that we're actually reclaiming the patty to be what it originally was. Well, you know, I'm giving away part of the book. But the other thing I wanted to do was I read a lot of books on hamburgers. And the fascinating thing was every single one of them ignored where the hamburger came from, ignored the cow, ignored the history of colonialism that brought about the sweeping changes to the Midwest Plains, the elimination of the buffalo, the moving of Native Americans from their native land into reservations. All of that paved the way for cows to be on that land. And then the advances at the end of the 19th century in terms of technology, refrigerated railroad cars, for instance, allowed dead cows to be dispersed from Chicago to other places. And all of this helped other technologies of violence, like the slaughterhouse itself and barbed wire, helped to create the environment in which hamburgers grew.
Well, you're the one who coined the phrase absent reverent.
Yes, and there I found it, for sure.
Here it is again.
Because the hamburger is so far distanced from the body of the cow, macerated, ground up. Now we know it could have pieces of cow from 1,000 different cows. And so it truly is a terrible and a great example of the absent referent in a tragic way. And what happened was that each of these hamburger historians completely reinforced this idea of the absent referent, ignoring how the cow becomes hamburger. So I wanted to put that back into the history too. So I have a chapter called Cow Burger that looks at that and the history of colonialism and the relationship between colonialism and the growth of the hamburger.
History is a fascinating thing, especially from the view of those who are telling it. I think about the book 1984, where we learn about it's a fictitious book, of course, but it talks about how history constantly changes based on those who are in control and how they want it perceived. And we still do that to this day. And I was surprised to see that even the Smithsonian couldn't get the history of the hamburger right.
Well, actually, what they get wrong is the history of the veggie burger. Because what they do, I mean, they might have also erred in other ways, but they trace the veggie burger only back to 1980. And I benefited from social media. I posted onto Facebook a few years ago and said, tell me examples of popular culture references to veggie burgers. And one person said, look at The 7 Year Itch, the movie from the Billy Wilder movie from the mid 1950s. And sure enough, the star is shown just after having finished consuming a soya burger. He's in a vegetarian restaurant. So you can't have veggie burgers be created in the 1980s if someone's eating a soya burger in a movie in 1956. But I thought what was interesting about that is that what it does is it just deprives us of the robust nature of the veggie burger in the 20th century. That really, from the moment the hamburger sort of makes it into the consciousness of the United States, which is at the end of the 1890s, it then suffers a setback with the publication in 1906 of The Jungle, then starts to come back. The first franchise really is White Castle, which is started in 1921. But all along, nipping at its heels, were veggie burgers, because people like John Harvey Kellogg were trying to create protein-rich meals for Seventh-day Adventists, 50% of whom follow a vegetarian diet. And so veggie burgers were being created, gluten patties, they were called, and you can find them in early 20th century cookbooks. by the 30s, you've got them advertised. You've got several companies that provide food to Seventh-day Adventists featuring a soya burger or another kind of sort of gluten burger. And then with World War II, there were meatless days and meat rationing. And the result was that companies like White Castle went looking for a veggie burger. And lo and behold, they found so many varieties. Even the New York Times celebrated soya burgers and bean burgers during World War II. There was a sense almost then that a soya burger was the food of the future. But we know that didn't happen back then.
Okay, I something just popped into my head just talking about White Castle, and I'm sure you don't know the answer to this, but I remember McDonald's tried a bunch of times to introduce veggie burgers. They tried like 10 years ago here in Manhattan, and it was disgusting. And the question is, why, with all of these options out there, why did they have to create something that wasn't palatable?
Well, I think what's more interesting is that the minute mad cow disease struck England, a London McDonald's in 1996 had a veggie burger.
And in India, they have them too.
Right. That's what I was going to say. So, I mean, maybe they'll go the way of White Castle. White Castle now has the Impossible Burger. I know Ethan Brown, when I met him, he's the founder of Beyond Meat and makes a mighty fine Beyond Burger. I know that his vision is for McDonald's to have Beyond Burgers, that this is all possible. How McDonald's can be this slow, not that we want to actually help support McDonald's, but the interesting thing I read for the book was that McDonald's provides 1% of the food for the whole world every day. But that doesn't mean it's burgers. When you look at how they adapt their food offerings, say in Russia with potatoes or cabbage, or in India, as you point out, with the veggie burgers, they're constantly adapting. I'd like to see them adapt right out of eating or serving cow burgers.
1% is way too much, but they are a company who are really a real estate company and not really a food company, and they have a lot of real estate all over the world. And if they could get with the program and help reduce the amount of animal suffering in the world, that would be a good thing. Let's talk about the word cow, because I was fascinated to find out that it was linked to the word money and capital.
So this is the interesting thing about etymologies, that cattle, this whole notion of what is capitalism, that capitalism is related to chattel and cattle. And so right from the beginning, I mean, there's an interesting etymology I talk about in the Sexual Politics of Meat that referred to cattle as the basis for one language's word for war. And I mean, one of the things we know about cattle is that cows, and I try to use the word cow rather than cattle so that we don't end up with this sort of use of cattle reinforcing capital. This is how it's traced, that the cattle is derived from the Middle English and Old Northern French cattel, and then the late Latin for capital. And so it's like chattel or chief property. So I was trying in the book to use cow rather than livestock or cattle. I mean, livestock itself reminds us of this capitalism aspect. But the fact about the cow is the cow needs space. The cow, Jeremy Rifkin calls the cow a hooved locust, that when cows aren't native to the United States or to North America, what we now know of as North America, cows are a product of colonialism in that they are brought to this land. And one of the things they did is they forced Native Americans to change how they farmed. because Native Americans in New England, the New England colonies, did not have fences. But they needed to put up fences to keep the cows from trampling their plants. So enclosures and the loss of common space all accompanied bringing cows over. Even by the 1850s, there is an environmentalist writing about how many cattle or cows take up land in the United States and how this is keeping the land from providing more food for people. 120 years before Diet for a Small Planet.
I'm fascinated about words, and not only words, but names. And I just want to throw this out because I think it's a bit Dickensian that two entrepreneurs that are promoting these new kinds of burgers, plant burgers, Ethan Brown and Pat Brown, their last names are both Brown. Burgers are brown. I'm thinking about, well, when I think about Bernie Madoff, who made off with everything, and when I think of the guy who's playing president right now and he's trumping everybody, I'm just always like connecting the dots between it's interesting who take the lead positions and their names.
Well, I think what's more interesting about Brown, and we should just say that Ethan and Pat are not related, is that they each have a burger that changes color.
Brown.
Yeah. So the veggie burgers we make, when we put them, you know, we make a great black bean burger, or you make a kidney bean burger, or you make a portobello burger, those burgers aren't really going to change colors when we cook them. But when you cook a Beyond Burger or have an Impossible Burger, I watched one being prepared when I visited the headquarters of Impossible Foods and met Pat Brown. When you watch these burgers being cooked, they change color. So I think that that's one of the innovations they're going for. When I've talked about this book, Burger, with audiences, whether it's in Toronto or Buffalo or wherever, there are some vegans who say, yes, but I don't want that taste. I don't want that texture. And my response is to remind them that what both Ethan and Pat Brown have said is they're not making these burgers for vegans. Yes, if vegans like that and have missed that kind of taste, fine, but they're really making it for meat eaters, flesh eaters. And so what I often say is that they're making it for people who are so craven that even though they know they shouldn't be eating dead cows at this point for environmental health and ethical reasons, they haven't figured out how to take that next step. So they're truly trying to reach the market that McDonald's is reaching or that high-end hamburger places are reaching, not our market, the market that we're known, you know, vegans are known for.
Yeah, I definitely can relate to that. I've tried these burgers. They do nothing for me, but I realize what they're doing, and anything, like I said before, that's going to reduce animal cruelty and suffering, you know, I'm all behind that. But humanity, we're really kind of a crazy species.
Well, I wouldn't say crazy.
Okay.
I think that we're
easily manipulated.
Well, I think one of the things that happened throughout the 20th century, I mean, the 20th century is categorized as a century in which production got displaced by consumption, so that the act of consumption is part of our identity. And that part of that, even though consumption does involve making decisions, it's a little more passive than production. And I think the evolution of the 20th century was towards more passivity. Oh, what does it matter what I do? So there's that's one way of passivity. I'm not going to cause any change. So what does it matter what I do? The second way of passivity is being on the receiving end of culture rather than being culture makers, TV watching, movie watching, et cetera. And so that passivity may create this inability to realize that each of us and our decisions about consumption actually matter. They're not the only thing that matters. I mean, if the United States stopped supporting animal agriculture, the hamburger would probably be $35. It would automatically not be competitive if the producers of hamburgers had to pay for the water pollution, the water use, had to actually clean up the water that they're polluting, had to not have the use of fossil fuels or have that be taxed more. They'd have a much more expensive product.
You're very diplomatic and nice to our fellow human beings.
I think that what happens, I talk about this in Living Among Meat Eaters, that people who aren't vegan think change is hard, but they're working harder not to change. They're working harder believing that what they've got is all they can achieve. They're just this side of the kind of liberation that teaches us that we're constantly changing. Becoming vegan isn't enough. Of course, we need to be very socially engaged around injustice at this time. So anyone who thinks that any of our goals is simply we'll become vegan and then you don't have to worry about anything. No, we need to be constantly attuned to the kind of social injustice that has helped to create a world in which hamburgers are cheap.
And like I said, it's not just hamburgers. I think of so many recipes that I'm always creating and recreating. And when I look into how they started or how they originated, so many of them change as people migrate and move around and different ingredients aren't available. So they change them. I mean, everything changes, even our food recipes.
Right. And that's part of the joy. But people also like comfort food. They want to know that something isn't changing. They want spaghetti like their grandmother made or you know, whatever. I mean, maybe Generation X isn't, it can't be described in that way. And I hope that they're breaking through on some of these areas. But for those who think they can't change, the Beyond Burger, the Impossible Burger, there's Hungry Planet. I want to mention Hungry Planet, which is based in the Midwest, and they have a great burger as well that's getting into cafeterias and high schools. I'm happy that we've got visionaries who are trying to respond at a different level while we activists are also responding at a grassroots level. Mm-hmm. I think we need all levels for change. I think one of the things about the burger is I was trying to, just as in the sexual politics of meat, help educate people who eat, who, I mean, first of all, anybody who reads is automatically also a person who eats since we all eat, but to educate readers about the hidden aspects of who they're eating. And so one of the chapters that I put in is about the modernist identity crises of the hamburger. How many different issues have arisen for the hamburger, from environmental to E. coli to mad cow, the McLibel trial in England, the Oprah trial here in Texas, all of the ways that eating a hamburger has been problematized. So I talk about the hamburger as having been a modernist solution to protein delivery that's now outmoded, that now has to be superseded, undone. It's an untenable solution, but a modernist solution. And just like modernist designs for public housing are seen as problematic. So the modernist response to protein delivery is problematic. And we've got the answers. Plant protein.
Single portion protein patties.
Right.
Okay, we just have a few minutes left. Can we talk a minute about libraries?
Sure.
Now, I love libraries in so many ways. And you dedicated your book to the memory of Forrest Gerard Nearing, the son of your colleague and friend, research librarian Jane Gerard Nearing. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. And all the work that she's done for you. Libraries are struggling just like so many other things because they require public funding. And tell me about your feelings about libraries.
I love libraries. I've been a library goer since I was in elementary school, and that library was 5 miles from our house. We did not have a library except the school library in the small village I grew up in. I've studied at the British Library, at the New York Public Library. I'd love to study at the Library of Congress. I've been there. The University of Rochester and Yale and Harvard libraries. I love the opportunity that we are given to learn about a variety of subjects just by walking through stacks. Mm-hmm. But in the case of Jane and her work on this book, for instance, I was trying to find the first references to soya burgers. And there she finds an ad for, and I refer to it in the veggie burger chapter, for a Thanksgiving dinner in a Midwest city that says, we've got everything you need, and it lists veggie burgers as one of them. And it's the mid-70s, the late 70s. And it just shows you that culture was changing so quickly. And she just digs in. She's a great example of how librarians want to help us be the best readers and thinkers we can be. And I'm so glad that you've raised the thing about who I dedicated the book to, because here's someone I never met, but I really felt that his mom and I were weaving together a memory of him through the research on this book. Mm-hmm. And I needed to mark that in mm-hmm. the dedication.
Okay, one last question. You taste a lot of plant burgers. Is there a favorite for you?
I love trying new burgers, and I have tried new burgers all this year, all over the country and in Toronto. It's sort of amazing. I like a black bean burger that we provide the recipe for in Never Too Late to Go Vegan. Mm-hmm. Once in a while, I like to have a portobello burger, which is just the portobello on bread. But my go-to that I'm using to introduce other people to it and that I have found is lots of fun to prepare with a variety of different accoutrements rather than condiments is the Beyond Burger. Mm-hmm. It's fun. And for those who haven't tried it, when I had it at the Beyond Meat headquarters, they cooked it medium heat with the skillet already warmed up. 3 minutes aside, and voila.
All right. Well, it's becoming easier and easier to get the Beyond Burger in many, many places. I see it all over the place, at least here in New York, and I'm often in California. And
I'd encourage people to try an Impossible Burger if they go out, or find out about more about Hungry Planet, because expanding the repertoire of our burgers, plant-based burgers is a great thing. We've got a great opportunity to help people change. And what better food to help them change with than the very ordinary U.S. loved, beloved, iconic burger.
That says it all. Thank you, Carol Adams, for joining me on It's All About Food for this very meaty discussion about your book, Burger.
Thank you. Plant-based meat.
Yes. Woo! Thank you. I look forward to everything else you're writing.
Thanks very much.
Okay. Bye-bye. That was Carol Adams, author of Burger, and I recommend it. I recommend it for many reasons. It's a great resource and tool if you need to have discussion points about the benefits of eating plant-based, and there's a lot of good history in there that can load you up on your facts. Very good.